I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal. Small, meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between. Today, we are chatting with Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs. They are the team behind Food 52, the premier online community for cooks of all levels with more than 60,000, recipes, a hotline, a kitchen, a home shop, an app, and best-selling cookbooks. Amanda Hesser was previously a writer and editor at the New York Times, an award-winning cookbook author, and Meryl Stubbs got her start in the test kitchen at Cooks Illustrated and went on to write for many food and lifestyle publications before working with Amanda on the Essential New York Times cookbook. And both Amanda and Meryl founded Food 52 in 2009. Wow, pretty crazy. And I, you know, in all transparency, I'm an investor in Food 52 from the very early days and always love what you guys are doing and love the whole story. So, you know, I obviously know a lot about both of you, but I think what would be interesting to talk about was what was your sort of first entrepreneurial moment together and also separately, because, you know, I really do believe journalists in the reality are entrepreneurs that are working under umbrellas to write their own content. But they have an entrepreneurial spirit. Why don't you guys just talk a little bit about, you know, how you sort of, in your head, did you always think you were going to start a business?
Do you want to go first with your individual tale?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was always, well, I had a very strong independent streak. I'm the youngest of four, and I'm there. It's like my siblings are like 1, 2, 3 in a row, and then there was like a 5-year break, which they like to call the accident.
That's hilarious.
But I do think like there is a dynamic created in a family often, and I think that in my family's case, you know, my parents had like literally risked everything to start a business. Like they were not college educated. They had like no family money, and they had four children, and they like basically took a bank loan and bought a business, and then like had to make it work. And so I grew up around that kind of environment, but I also think my sort of like placement in the family had a big effect on like sort of just my sense of like what I could do, and I didn't really feel like many limitations. It manifested itself in lots of ways.
Watching your parents build a business, I think, makes a big difference.
It makes a huge difference, and I think like a very strong formative moment was 3 years after my parents bought the business, and it was like the 70s, the oil crisis, it was a car business, like things were not great. It burnt to the ground.
Oh my God.
Yeah, in a giant fire, because if you like if you light cars filled with gasoline on fire, it makes a giant fire. My dad was open for business the next day. He rented a trailer and he had a used car parking lot that didn't burn. And he was like, he wanted to like say, he's kind of like make a statement, I think, to himself as much as to like his customers that this was not going to be the end of his story. And that had a big effect on me.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And so the thing I was thinking was just like, you know, I was always kind of coming up with little, you could call them schemes. But what I did was, I was in college and I realized that I was interested in cooking. But I didn't, you know, my parents had just paid for, you know, 4 years of college, and how could I ask them to then like send me to cooking school? So I what I did was I just came up with an itinerary for myself as another scheme, which involved like applying to a cooking school in Europe, but also setting up a bunch of internships around in four different countries. And I found like some culinary organization. It's called Les Dames d'Escoffier, which has kind of chapters in many different cities in the U.S. And they gave scholarships to U.S. Cooking schools. And I knew that, but I thought, well, I don't want to go to U.S. cooking school. I want to go study in Europe. So what I did is I drafted a proposal. I got agreements from these chefs and restaurant owners and bakery owners around Europe. I went and saw them on my spring break. And just to like let them know that I was actually real, and you know, because back then you literally wrote letters.
No,
to people,
that was it.
Know?
Yeah.
And so then I came back with my proposal. I got a meeting with the Les Dames d'Escoffier, and I baked a bunch of chocolate cakes, and I showed up with my proposal and my chocolate cakes, and told them what I wanted to do and how much money I would need, And I also had laid out a schedule of how I would like report on my learnings.
which is great.
And they went for
data.
It. They gave me everything.
This is so revealing hearing you tell this, because I think that my experience and yours highlight the differences in our personalities. And I'd never thought about the sort of where we lie in terms of birth order, but I feel pretty certain that has something to do with it now that you're telling your full story. Because I was the older child of two, only two. And as Amanda knows, I am very much at heart a rule follower. I like to do my homework. It gives me a great sense of peace and satisfaction. And I definitely inherit that from, I would say, both my parents, but even more from my dad, who was also an entrepreneur, but in a different style, I think, than, you know, what you've described, mm-hmm. because my dad is also very much a rule follower. He's slightly obsessive about things, but he did not let that stop him from starting not one, but actually multiple businesses throughout his life. He does it in a very sort of particular fashion, and I think
methodical.
You know, yeah, methodical, exactly. And Amanda, you were talking about sort of breaking the rules and creating a new kind
paradigm.
A new paradigm. And I think I've always had, an entrepreneurial bent that has been maybe more within the sort of like structure or like the existing paradigms, until I would say we started 52 when I felt like I've sort of like started to break out of my shell a little bit. Amanda gets very proud of me when I like follow the rules.
But it's funny because I saw that with you too from get-go, you know?
I find it very comforting to that, because I
someone's
feel like
following the rules?
Well, yeah, somebody has read all the documents and she follows the rules and like kind of keeps, I feel like Meryl is like the, what is it in sailing, that like
the
rudder, the keeps us balanced and like going in the right direction.
Right.
I like to execute. I mean, I think I like ideas too. So when I was thinking about my first true entrepreneurial experience, it was I took a familiar model, but I was like obsessed with doing it really well. So I actually started a Jack's rental business in the third grade, during recess.
I love Jack's. I was obsessed with Jack's.
Yeah.
Did you do Israeli Jack's too?
What are Israeli Jack's?
Oh, they're like these little square Jack's. It's like five square Jack's. It's a whole different game.
Oh.
But that was very big at camp.
Wait, but they weren't the ring ones too, right? The plastic rings.
Oh, of course. No.
Then they're the metal, old school ones.
Yeah.
I mean, we rented both types.
Both kinds?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. Different prices, of course. Price tier. and I like, you know, but my, the.
So you put all your challengers out of business?
Yeah. There weren't really any, but we wiped them out before they got any ideas. But I think for me, the satisfaction came from like identifying a need, a very clear need. It wasn't, you know, everyone was like obsessed with Jack's, and then capitalizing on it and like running it very,
very well.
Very well.
Interesting.
So I think, I do think that that's sort of like a key difference between the two of us. And I think it's one of the, you know, we have a lot of things that are sort of, people tend to think that we're very similar because we have similar taste, I think. Uh-huh. And that's reflected in
the brand.
Voice and in the brand.
Absolutely.
But our personalities and our approaches to the business, I think, are quite different. And
complimentary. I think it's great. Yeah, I feel like it's very complimentary. And it makes me think, so my husband, Tad, is, he's the eldest in his family. And, I don't know. He was reading somewhere that apparently, like, is often a good matchup, like the youngest and
with the oldest.
And
that's really interesting.
You know,
nice job. That's very good. Well, you guys started in really when this book, the Essential
New York Times Cookbook,
that you started working together.
Yeah.
I mean, that was really the first time.
Yeah. And we didn't know each other at all.
Right.
We were just introduced by a colleague of mine and sort of secondhand.
Or friend of a friend.
Second degree friend, uh-huh. Yeah. And
secondhand friend.
I don't know what that is. That sounds so
recycled.
Unpleasant. Your upcycled friend. So we just like literally started cooking together because we had tons of recipe testing that needed to get done.
More than we knew at the time.
Oh, man.
If we only knew, we probably would have never done it.
Yeah. But it was it.
Well said.
It was this unintentional, obviously, but completely lucky time period where we spent so much time together in the kitchen and really got to know each other. I had my kids during that period. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so we got to know each other, like, personally, you know, we became good friends. And professionally, and like, and I think just got a sense of each other's sort of strengths, and just we're immersed in our industry, and so we talked about it all the time.
Right. And what was the brilliance of that cookbook when all these people started sending you these recipes that they were like yellowed and they had from years ago, and that, you know, that was the impetus of Food 52 weeks a year of different recipes and food, and that's how it started. Although I know from both of you is that even though that was the impetus, you had a much bigger long-term vision, mm-hmm. Which you have always, you know, followed, mm-hmm. and it's worked.
Yeah.
You know, which I applaud you both on that, because I think a lot of founders start with a vision, but not a real vision in regards to what they want, what's the brand's going to look like, what are the other platforms we feel we need to roll out that will integrate into this one huge conglomerate, essentially. It's pretty interesting.
Well, you know, we definitely met with resistance from the beginning, as you know, about mm-hmm. focus. Right. It was all about
because
not
you really
being
shouldn't share
on one thing.
Right. Which is you really shouldn't share with most investors that big idea at the beginning.
Yeah.
I've told founders that many times, which is like, I get it. I love to talk about that, but most people will think you're not focused.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? Because something could happen and you end up in another path. And so you have the fear is that these founders aren't leaving themselves open and
they're
agile
so
for
this.
Change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where that comes from. But, you know, you had your children while you guys were cooking. You had your children when the business started.
Yep.
And I do think is from someone as an outside perspective watching both of you grow through this business is that, you know, I'm not so sure that you thought, who's someone who follows rules, that you were going to be, you know, in this business and stay in this business and be this amazing entrepreneur with a great partner, that you would have been like, okay, I have my kids, maybe I'll stay home for a while. And I think that this shift in saw it was happening was a great thing. I'm not so sure this would have been the path that you
would
have
chosen. Intentionally, I think you're right. And I actually, I give Amanda a ton of credit for kind of like seeing, I think from the very beginning, like, further down the road than I could, and kind of inspiring me, and in some cases like pulling me along at times for sure. And I think we've done that with each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly been moments where we've each struggled, typically not at the same time, which is lucky, but we've had times when it's been hard for both of us. But you know, having the other person to really kind of keep you motivated and excited and looking, you know, further ahead than just next week, which can often, you know, look can be a lot more positive if you're looking further ahead.
Yeah,
than if you're
I mean, there's definitely the roller coaster ride of the startup
world.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, what do you guys think cumulatively? What was some of the biggest misstep you took as you grew this brand? I mean, you're inevitably going to step into potholes, particularly in a business that is not classically backed by institutional investors with the hope that they would help you avoid those potholes. Not necessarily always true, but you want to believe it is true.
Yeah. Well, we talked about two different things.
Yeah.
Because
we knew this question was coming.
Oh, there you go.
That's right. Yeah. I feel like there's a category of things that we did that we feel like were mistakes, but then there's also things that, like, you do wonder, like, well, should we have done more of?
Right.
Right? One of the things that I've just, like, off the top of my head that I was thinking that I sometimes wonder if we should have done more of in the early days was, like, SEO work, because we are search engine optimization, because we are, we have so many recipes on our site, and that's the beauty of recipes, and actually the beauty of most food content is that it's evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has such intense value if you can be surfacing it well.
Right.
Right?
But I remember you doing, a whole SEO thing
some.
Way
some.
Back in the day.
Yes, we've done some. We've done it sort of like piecemeal, like when we could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
But we've never, like, invested heavily. I sometimes wonder about that.
You still can.
There's still time. Yeah. That's true. There's always time. And that's sort of, yeah. But I think that the things that we were discussing.
Yeah, sure. So I think one thing, I think it would be hard. It was hard for us to come up with kind of the one misstep. I think it's more a collection of medium-sized
curated
groups. Yeah, exactly. but one of the ones that we talked about was the first major site redesign that we did. Which was, oh my gosh, do you even remember what year that was? Probably 2011?
Yeah,
2000.
Well, it was when you were pregnant with Clara.
That was 2011.
Yeah.
Exactly. She was born January 2012.
Yeah.
And we devoted a lot of time and all of our engineering resources and most of our own brains, you know, to working with an outside firm to come in and help us redesign the site, the look and feel of the site. And, I mean, it was months and months and months, everyone on the team working on it all the time. And it was really not driven by any data of any kind. And when we launched it, it kind of stunk. and it stank on two fronts because it did something that we knew was going to happen. Because people don't like change, which is that it pissed off
Where's this? Loyal followers, yes.
Right? Well, we knew that was going to happen.
Right.
And we steeled ourselves for that, and we said, but the more important thing is to do this, you know, make the site more user-friendly for a wider audience,
right?
And so we got to drown out the noise a little bit. But the problem was it wasn't a better experience for users.
Right.
And I think really it's because we didn't have the kind of data we have now,
right.
Number one.
Which is tremendous.
There wasn't the same kind of sort of expectation around using data to make product decisions, I don't think. It was a different time.
Well, you know, it's an interesting topic because I've seen this time and time again with companies, particularly companies that have just enough cash. They don't have a really big, deep technology team. And that the big technology companies where, you know, they are really they're technology-driven businesses. Mm-hmm. You are not a technology-driven business, even though technology is the backbone of your business, is that they do this all in-house.
Right.
And because everyone knows, you know, what's happening. And I've seen this again with e-commerce platforms, brand platforms, that they hire these large companies to do it. And, you know, I even know that my sister just did this for the Women's Entrepreneur Festival, which is a whole nother story in itself. And she managed these people to such a degree and beat them up and went and got in there that we end up with this amazing product. But, you know, and we got it for the right price. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot spend money, realize the product sucks, then spend more money, then want to bring it in-house. You know, now you have a big team. You know, those are the changes you can make internally.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things, all these companies exist out there to supposedly help you. And if you talk to every one of their clients, maybe 50% were happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do think outsourcing is sort of the bigger misstep.
Yes.
And luckily, we only did it a couple of times before we caught on. But I think we always caution other
to
early
outsource
stage founders.
Against doing it is like there's this, it's a tough one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you only have limited inside.
Yeah.
And then you have to have someone making sure they're really on top of those outsourcing people.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to ignore them.
You think
them
it's just gonna be done if you outsource it. But in fact it's
just another project
to manage it.
100%.
Yeah.
So what's the other one?
Well, the other is hiring people who are too senior too soon.
Interesting.
There's like a push and pull, right? Because I think in the early days, especially if you're out raising money, there's pressure to like get people on your team who
have a little gray
hair, who have a fancy resume that's going to give comfort to an investor, but it often means someone who is sufficiently far enough along in their career that, like, the gritty kind of like dirty work of getting a company off the ground.
They don't want to do it.
They don't want to do it, and it's not a good use of their skills because they're not actually able to apply their deep knowledge often because you're just not at a place where you need it quite yet.
Right.
You know, and so you're overpaying yeah. or giving away too much equity. And then you're
very
feeling
frustrated.
And you're feeling frustrated because you're like, come on, you know, we need more out of you. But it's you're kind of in a position of asking more than they could actually deliver.
Or what they expected to deliver.
Yes. And so there's just this tension, I think that, you know, when you're starting out between like what you need internally and what you're kind of showing externally. And I think that that has at moments we've made mistakes.
Right.
You know, nothing like terrible, but ones that we felt like, okay, we learned from that. We're not doing that again.
Right.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And I have seen it time and time again with companies. It's like, I've said, that person actually had 3 assistants.
Right.
They don't even know what they can do because they've got all these resources. But there is a push-pull. And you know, you also see it at the beginning. You hire all these junior people, and maybe out of the 7 of them, one of them is able to rise to the next level. And then you feel like, oh, my God, we have to get rid of all these people and sort of start again. But that is just the nature of these businesses.
Yeah.
I mean, it just is. And then, you know, you then end up with, at one point, a senior team, and then you bring back all those junior people underneath them. You know, it's hard. It, particularly in a company like yours where there's so many different layers of the business, you guys have so many different businesses under one umbrella that, you know, you need a lot of junior people in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not easy, but I think that, like, you know, if you're... Because you're really, like, helping people with their careers, right? Because if somebody's at your company and they're struggling, like, that's not... It's not good for your company. It's not good for them.
Completely.
It's not good for their self-confidence. It's not good for their career trajectory. And, like, if you can kind of help them understand that, that they're not able to get to where they won't need to within the sort of confines of our business, doesn't mean they can't, you know, continue to thrive elsewhere.
Right.
It's just, but they've got to, you know, they have to do that hard work of kind of figuring out what that next
I think that's
is.
Great. I mean, it really is. I mean, I see young people, someone I know talking to yesterday, a young man who graduated from college a year ago, and he's now in his 3rd interview with the company. You know, and I think that is something of this generation of startups, which is to ensure that person is really the right culture fit and is going to learn a lot there, and working for someone who's going to usher your career forward. You know, that really wasn't something that was thought about, at least, you know, when I took a job. It was like, you checked off the boxes, you went to the top, we hired you, if it works out, great, if it doesn't, it doesn't. And
right.
So I think it's really great. But I also think that what you're talking about, which is so unique to the industry of startups, which is something we'll look back in history and say, at this time, you know, so many of these businesses were started that changed everything, is that you go from an idea, which came out of, you know, the New York Times Essential Cookbook, to the 2 of you, to hiring 1, to 4, to 10, to 50, and in between raising money and building other businesses. And you never managed anyone before. I mean, you never ran a company before. And as much as the people underneath you are trying to help them, their careers, you know, you're learning on the fly on how you're managing your careers.
Yeah, and bigger and bigger teams very quickly. I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier today too, that, you know, your job is constantly changing as the founder of a company that's growing. And, you know, you may be doing one thing or focusing most of your time on one particular area one day, and then 6 months later, it looks completely different.
Yeah.
And you have to be okay with that.
Right.
You know, and with this sort of like discomfort and the instability and all of those things. And I think obviously the best case scenario is if you can actually learn to enjoy it and realize how much you're learning.
Roll with the punches. So
yeah.
That's great for the next question. So what was the thing that you both learned through this journey that you had no idea that you thought you would?
Well, I don't want to answer in the same way or, you know, what you just covered, but it is true that the surprises never stop coming. Like,
that is a good line.
just when you think you've figured something out.
It's like raising children.
Great analogy. Yeah, you turn a corner and you think, oh, okay, well, I've reached this new place and I get this. And then there's a sort of a wrench thrown in. And you know, it's always interesting and like a great new challenge, but it's just, you don't know when they're coming and they just keep.
Yeah. And I think that there's this fantasy
yeah.
that you're constantly operating under, even though you learn the lesson, you know, time and time again, that the next stage is going to be the one where like there's sort of some kind of status quo for a little bit at least. And then it just never comes.
It never comes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you have to like that in some weird, you know, masochistic way.
Well, yes, for sure. I mean, I think all entrepreneurs are masochists in some way, yeah. right? I mean, I think it's probably more difficult for someone who's 21 years old that starts a business. I mean, you guys had a really interesting careers, both of you, before you went down, you know, started this journey. So I think that makes for some real life learning, which is worthwhile for sure. But
we feel like it is. Well, I don't know if anyone else agrees with that.
I think it is. Like, and having children on top of that. I mean, I just yeah. think that is so hard. I mean, you had two during this journey. Kelsey, you know, from Venue Book, not only did she have two during the journey, I remember she was closing her bridge round on a Saturday morning, and then she called me at 5 o'clock later that afternoon. She goes, I just had the baby. And it's like, oh my gosh. You know, I mean, you know, men don't have to do that.
I wish I had that story.
You know, men definitely don't have to do that. I mean, and I actually think having children makes you a better manager of your time in regards to running a business because,
yes.
you know, at the end of the day, those are the most important people and things in your lives. And so how do you manage this and still be able to sort of separate one from the other versus this like complete immersion in your business that you don't ever like pick up your head and breathe?
It does force you to learn how to prioritize.
Yeah.
Better, I think, across the board.
Yeah, I feel like it helps you enjoy mm-hmm. both more.
Yeah, like, I agree.
Because, yeah, they're both so intense. And so having kind of like the break from each mm-hmm. other, you know, mm-hmm. It makes you appreciate when you come back to the
yeah.
other one.
Yeah. Well, it's also nice for your kids to see. I mean, your kids are still super young.
But they're starting to get it. Yeah, yeah, my older one is starting to definitely, I mean, she's hanging out in the office a lot more.
Which is so crafting. Nice. I mean, I think it's great for kids to see this is what mom does and how hard mom works. Particularly if we're really going to break this gender divide to something super duper equal, you know, that women that have children and then never return to the workforce, they're not really showing their kids the importance of work and having your own space.
Mm-hmm. Well, Addison, Amanda's daughter, came in, both Walker and Addison came in to spend a day at the office, specifically with the intention of like sort of standing in Amanda's shoes for a day, like actually going with her to meetings and participating in Addison's case, asking lots of good questions. And Addison actually got up in front of our entire company. We have 65 people during our company-wide meeting, which we have once a week, and she read a quote to everyone. And it was like, it was a very moving moment because she wasn't nervous at all, first of all. It was like, can you just run our meetings from now on, please?
That's so great.
But it was also like, she was, I mean, in one of the meetings, someone was delivering some tough news to us. Mm-hmm. And she was there for that. And I thought, like, this is so great.
That's awesome.
Because it's not all, you know, I didn't want her to see like a sort of perfectly curated day.
Right.
Yeah. See what my day, you know, mm-hmm. is like. And what work is like and what
just like you yeah. saw what your father was
yeah.
like
yeah.
your parents
yeah that's but awesome. She came prepared. It was like she knew that this was the quote that she
right.
wanted to.
Well, you guys have always come prepared, so no shocker. Okay. All right, well, thanks again to Amanda and Merrill for joining us on Positively Gotham Gal.
Thank you.
If you have not had a chance to check out Food 52 yet, I highly recommend you do. I know I buy a lot of stuff from there, and I will tell you, the recipes always work. Food 52 is above all community for people looking to eat thoughtfully and live joyfully. Check it out at food52.com. And I will say, I think one of the things that's really unique about the community in regards to the recipes, you know, it's like the best chefs in America in their own homes. And that is the place where they all go, which makes it really unique. Anyway, thanks again for listening, and tune in next week for Positively Gotham Gal, and please subscribe to us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Thanks.